You get home, but home doesn't feel like home anymore. The noise in your head never really stops. The calm moments feel like they're missing something, and that something might just be danger. You try to sit still at work, but your eyes keep scanning the exits. You love your family, but a part of you aches for the brotherhood, the purpose, the raw intensity that civilian life just can't touch. Ben Sykes knows this fight. From a Hollywood desk job to a Marine machine gunner in the invasion of Iraq, he's lived through firefights, adrenaline highs, and the brutal crash landing back into civilian life. In this conversation, we're going to talk about that rush, the withdrawal, and the road back to finding purpose in civilian life. But before we begin, I do want to take a moment to raise awareness for something deeply important to our community, the Global War on Terrorism Memorial Foundation. This organization is working to build a permanent national memorial in Washington, D.C. to honor the service members, families, and civilians who were impacted by the Global War on Terrorism. This memorial will serve as both a tribute to those who served and a way to ensure that their sacrifices are recognized and remembered for generations to come. If you would like to learn more or find out how you can support the mission, visit GWATMemorialFoundation.org. Now let's get into today's episode. Ben, welcome to the show. Really glad to have you here. Looking forward to this conversation.
Yeah. Great to be here. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Yeah, you bet. I always like to do this with folks when we first start talking, just to get a little bit information about their background, a little bit of their military history, that type of thing. You were in Iraq, and you know the whole story better than I do. Tell us the whole story. Tell us about who you are, your background, your military experience, and kind of lead into the transition out of the military and kind of how all that went for you.
Yeah, no problem. So 9/11, I'm living in North Hollywood. I'm working on flash websites for the studios at the time. I'm 27 years old. I was drinking a 40 ounce. I don't drink anymore. 40 ounce in the morning. I'm listening to Howard Stern, and he seems a little off today. And I know what's going on. I turn on the television with the bunny ears because I didn't have cable at the time. And I kind of caught what was happening. And truth be told, I was sort of like, oh, man, that's wild. And then the second plane hit, and you're like, oh, okay. But it really didn't shock me at the time. I was too focused on work.
Sure.
And then all my contracts, obviously the world changed instantly, and all of my contracts stopped. So I thought, well, what am I going to do now? I got to get a job. And I was working for myself at the time, and so I applied for any job that I could find that was in tech or web design or whatnot. And I got a hit. And so I went to this company, it was in Chatsworth, and I showed up, and I know it was an office park, and all the cubicles had shower curtains around them, which I thought was kind of weird.
It is strange, yeah.
But I had a good interview, and it was good. It was going to run their web properties of this company. And then, I thought, okay, well, I got some leads. And again, everything had stopped. 9/11, as changed everything. And so a couple of days later, they called me again, and they said, why don't we want you to come back for a second interview? I said, great. I came back and met in the conference room, talked to everybody. And then, shortly thereafter, they made me an offer. And the company was, I didn't know at the time, I kind of all put it together at the end, was ABN, Adult Video News. They put on the Porn Awards every year in Vegas. And I thought, I don't think that's what I want to be doing. And I'm watching an infomercial. This is all true. I'm watching an infomercial like 2 a.m. I can't sleep. And it's like, something about if you're 80 years old and you have regrets, you probably should have done it when you had the chance. And I thought, this is my opportunity to enlist in the military. I always wanted to. This is it. I'm 27. I'm going to give it a shot. I went down to the Van Nuys recruiting station, and I walked in there, and they kind of looked at me and laughed like, what are you talking about? It's for the Marine Corps. And sure enough, you've got September 11th, 2001, October 31st. So a month later on Halloween at midnight, yellow footprints. And that's where it started. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah. Off to the races, and we're in it. And, I when I went through the recruiting process, what do you want to be? I'm thinking, I want to be a recon. And they sort of laughed at me and said, "You're a machine gun." I said, "Good to go."
Right, exactly. I remember when I was in basic training, I wasn't, you know, quite the same age, but I was on the older end of the folks who were in
basic
training.
Oh, you were, yeah.
Yeah, I think I was like 24, 25, something like that. And when I was going through basic training, and yeah, 24. And I remember being on the 50 cal range, and I'm sitting there, I'm shooting, and I'm thinking, they are paying me to do this. This is,
I know,
awesome.
Right?
You know?
Yeah.
And so how was it going through basic as, you know, one of the older guys going through? You're not a, you know, 17, 18 year old kid, you know, just fresh out of high school. And what was that like for you? Was it tough to keep up for you? Or
no, well, I got to tell you. So I had difficulty with the PFT originally, but I had a first class PFT at the end of it. I loved it. Absolutely loved it. And because of my age, and they found out that I had done some work in films when I was living in LA. So they're like, "You're going to be a scribe." So I'm scribing throughout the entire thing. I was older than all my drill instructors. And yeah, I loved it. Sometimes I wish, is there a way that I could go back, just do boot camp again, kind of get my head straight. And then,
Right. But
I loved it. I mean, we all say we loved it, but there were so many days, and if you're a Hollywood Marine like myself at MCRD, man, you just see all those planes taking off from San Diego Airport because it's right next door, and you're thinking, I would do anything to be on one of those planes, go get the hell out of here.
Yeah, I mean, in the moment, it, like, looking back on it now, it's like, wow, that was great. That was awesome. I would do it again. But in the moment, sometimes it's like, man, this sucks. Like your muscles are sore, you're tired, you're hungry. Everything's sucking in that moment. But looking back on it, it's like, man, I would do that again. You know, I get it.
You know, it's funny because people see a full metal jacket and they think, man, that looks hard. But the reality is, like, so in full metal jacket, you had a senior drill instructor and then that was it.
Right.
The reality is you've got four guys that are just ruthless. So it's much worse than the film. I mean, much worse than that film. One senior drill instructor, that's great. And senior drill instructor always plays the good cop. But yeah, it's so much worse than the movie ever was. And God, I mean, you know, I don't think I would want it any other way now, looking now, but.
Right. Well, and it's good that it's difficult too, because you don't want people coming through, you know, becoming Marines or soldiers or sailors or whatever, and they're not prepared for the realities of the jobs, right? And so,
So
it's got to be difficult. So that, I think that's a good thing. They did their job in that case, right?
Oh, they did.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about, you know, kind of post basic training. I mentioned a deployment to Iraq. What was that deployment like for you? What were you up to there, and any interesting stories from there?
Oh, we had a ton of them, actually. So, you know, get out of boot camp and then I got the 10-day boot leave. And you kind of fall through the cracks when you're older. So I didn't have a job, and I had one now. I was working for Uncle Sam, but what am I going to do with my apartment? So I had to move out of my apartment. My lease, coincidentally, my lease was up. So it worked out. So where am I going on 10-day boot leave? I don't have family to stay with. So I stayed on the couch of my next door neighbors of the apartment I used to live in, which was interesting, for 10 days. And then I was able to get a ride back to Pendleton for a school of infantry. And, you know, school of infantry was much more demanding physically, because, I mean, you're in class all day, you're running all morning, you're in class all day, and then you're on the range and you're carrying, you know. So I'm a 03-31 machine gunner, 50 cal Mark 19 and the M240 Golf. All those weapon systems, assembly, disassembly, all day, every day. You're humping with them, you're running with them, the whole thing. And the Mark 19 is not, it's not light, not
no,
at all.
It's not.
And then, of course, there's the ammo as well. You've got to hump that as well. So School of Infantry was a rude awakening in some ways. But you get there and you think that, you know, you're in the boot camp mentality. And then all of a sudden you have this freedom. And you're like, what am I supposed to do? I don't know what to do. So it was a bit of an adjustment.
Yeah.
But no, I it was great. So School of Infantry, and then after School of Infantry, because I signed up as a reservist 1 week in a month, 2 weeks a year nonsense, which wasn't the case because I was activated immediately. So I went home briefly, but I didn't have a home. So I ended up living out of my car. Oh. in Venice Beach. I didn't have an apartment, so I lived out of my car, and I'm like, well, I have this, there's a window. I probably should have just joined the fleet immediately after that, but I got an apartment, and I finally found a job. So it didn't take too long, but in this window of time. And then once I started working, I think it was like 2 weeks into the job, I get a phone call from First Sergeant. He says, hey, Sykes, I got some good news and some bad news. And I'm like, all right, lay on me, First Sergeant. He's like, you got 10 days to get your life together. I'm like, what are you talking about? He's like, you get deployed. So I'm like, all right. So 10 days, I got to do will and testament. I got to do power of attorney, all this sort of stuff. And I got to tell my new roommate, because I just finally found a place. I'm like, hey, I'm probably going to be the best roommate you've ever had, because I'm just not going to be here for like maybe a year or so long, or ever. We don't know if we're coming back.
That's right, yeah.
So then, yeah, so we're back at Pendleton. We're in the field 24/7. I mean, we're living in the field. And because we're reserve unit, we've got a lot to prove, and a lot of the guys are ex-police or SWAT or whatever. So, you know, we're like, you're not special at all. So we really just got hammered. And then, yeah, we flew to Iraq and ended up providing security for, so we lay, you know, we flew to Iraq, we stopped in Shannon, which now is public, but at the time it wasn't. We landed in Shannon. And of course, you know, we're flying just a commercial airline. So all the Lance Corporals and privates and whatnot. So you're loading the plane because they don't have the staff to do it. Mm-hmm. So you're loading all of that, and then all the firearms, all the, you know, all the weapon systems, all of those are underneath the seats.
Yep.
Right. So, I mean, to see it, I mean, if you're, you know, so this, you know, then obviously there's regular stewardesses and stewards, so we had to be on our best behavior. But we fly to Shannon, we stop in Shannon, we have a Guinness, which was great, got a photo op, and then we go from Shannon directly to Kuwait. And then from there, they funnel us to Camp Commando, which is where everyone was a staging for all Allied forces. So we had, you know, British Royal Marines and SEALs and whatnot. So we're there for a long period of time. We're doing gas mass runs, doing all the stuff, because our job is going to be, you know, weapons of mass destruction. And we were going to have to be in MOP 4, which we were for a large portion. And yeah, what happens? We cross the LOD and we're in it. So we're a day behind Jessica Lynch in the Battle of Nazaria. And we're in a convoy. I mean, it's like you're in traffic on the 35 in Austin here. You're in a convoy waiting. And as we get closer and closer, there's more bodies. And there's more wreckage. And there's more bodies. And then we see a Abrams turret off. And you're like, whoa. And here we are. And it's just, now we're in the fight. So we're in a full-on firefight. We got 1-4 on the ground and prone. Guy turns around. He's like, kill these motherfuckers. And we just unloaded, I mean, M240 Golf on this entire building. And they didn't have tracks for us, right? So we're on 7 tons with sandbags the entire time. So we're sitting ducks, but we don't care. We're like, we know our job. Everyone kept their sector of fire intact. So we're taking massive fire, and we're, you know, and then we keep moving through. We keep moving through. And I'll tell you, it was the greatest sort of mind-freaking you'd ever imagine, is that there's a couple of Marines that are sitting on MRE boxes having chow. Like nothing's going on. And you're like, what is that? Like, there's a firefight. It's right there. It's like 50 yards away. And these guys are like, and it was the weirdest thing. It was so bizarre.
Didn't even faze them, kind of?
What is this? And it reminded me, actually, what's the movie Apocalypse Now, where all of a sudden they have this Playboy convention in the middle of the jungle, and you're like, that's not realistic at all. And now I'm like, oh yeah, that's totally realistic. I could totally see that happening.
Sure.
So we're in Nazaria. We're going all the way up the Euphrates. We're going from each individual town, and we're doing raids, and we're looking for weapons of mass destruction. We're all in MOP 4. You know, just without the gas mask, and then gas comes down, we're MOP 4, the whole deal. It continues on. I'll just keep going if you want.
Sure. Yeah. I think, deployments, you know, you mentioned something like, you know, having your rifles and everything on the plane, like under the seats and stuff. That was the same experience I had too. So I know exactly what you're talking about. It was, that was like a surreal thing. But a lot of the stuff that happens during a deployment, especially, you know, someone's first deployment, you know, if you have multiple deployments, you start to know what is normal and what is abnormal and stuff.
Sure.
When you're going into a deployment in a combat zone, Iraq, Afghanistan, any of those types of places, everything is pretty much abnormal to you that first time. You step off the plane and, you know, the culture is different. And then how people react in, you know, a combat situation when there's bullets flying overhead or, you know, bombs being exploded or all those things. You don't know how people are going to react until they're in that situation.
It's true.
You could have the guy who's, you know, talks the most shit and, you know, in training, and he's like, oh yeah, no, I would do this and I would do that and I would do things.
I saw that in person. Yeah,
exactly. And then the bullets start flying and they just shut the fuck up and they don't know.
That's right.
Right. And
that's right.
And you have, and then everything in between. You might have someone who is like nervous and, you know, in training, and they're like timid and all that, and then real bullets start flying and they become a stud.
Yes.
And so you really don't know how that's going to take place, but it's, I guess just really everybody's experience is going to be different when it comes to a deployment like that. And, you know, I'm sure your deployment, and especially, you know, being in that same area, like kind of right around the time of the Jessica Lynch and everything like that, there's a lot of media attention on what's going on in that area. And so that probably, I would imagine, complicated things a little bit for you guys, or was it just kind of like another one of those things you just kind of brushed off and didn't even think about?
Well, we had, so Rick Leventhal from Fox, I've since connected with him on Instagram years later, but he was our embed, but we were in the front. So there was, we were just like, we're just going. So okay. We didn't.
So that wasn't even an issue, right?
No, not a bit. And yeah, it was, we were just going, and we were, you know, in firefights throughout all the way until we got to Baghdad, where we were ambushed. And more, we got to see the guys with ILS, right? Imaginary lad syndrome, suddenly fold.
Sure.
And you're like, yeah, I saw that. But before I get into, like, we're getting into Baghdad and like, we had some pretty big milestone sort of experiences. One of the things that nobody talks about, which was sort of like a rude awakening, is like the moment where you're like, there's no place to shit. So how is that going to work? So you're in a giant convoy in the middle of nowhere, and then all of a sudden, like, people got to go. Oh, how does this, I mean, that's like, Welcome to reality. So there you go. Everyone's just, you're just dropping trowel in the middle of a field. You're like, interesting. Okay. Yeah. So that's new. And that was like for the entire deployment. And then the first time you get shot at, you're like, wait, is this really happening?
Yeah. The bullets are coming this way, not the other way. Like,
that's right. You're like, what the hell? Wait, think like, oh, okay. Wait. All right. So, you know, what is it? What do they say? They say, well, it's a mechanism. It's called normalcy bias, right? It is not your normalcy bias. Like, oh, come on. This isn't really happening. Normalcy bias is not your friend in combat. So you need to kill that instantly. But yeah, there's a bit of that in the beginning. Like, wow, is this really happening? And then sure enough, it was just all the time.
And then unfortunately, that becomes normal when it's happening all the time. And it's like, oh, now I know how to react at least. But that's a new normal, right?
Anyway, we made it up to Baghdad, and then we got to, I mean, these are just sort of the big highlights because there was a lot of stuff in between. But somehow I remember we're going through a field, we're on foot, we're going through a field, and then we come out to this road, and I just see these UN vehicles. And I have all these photos too. Because we had these, in my LBV, I had a couple of, a bunch of guys, that we had disposable cameras because it was kind of pre-digital age.
Right.
And all these, I'm like, what is the UN doing here? And it was basically the UN compound had been raided by the locals. So we go in and we affix bayonets at one point. We go in and clear, and we're like, where is the, and there's this fire coming up. Our snipers were on the roof of the UN building. So we funnel into the UN building, and I'm with my gun team, Sergeant Arzate, Ruiz, and myself. And so Ruiz takes the M240 Golf to the roof, and then we basically go in to the UN building, which had since been vacated. But it was the only place where there was alcohol. So we go in, and all the, it was like something out of a movie. All the fridges, you open them up, they were all moldy. And we're going in, I'm going in with Sergeant Arzate, and we are clearing all the rooms. So we're kicking in rooms and clearing, kicking in rooms and clearing. We get to the very top, and I think I'm pretty certain I was sitting, I guess, Kofi Annan's desk. I was sitting there, I put my feet up at one point. I thought, wow, okay. It was just a surreal day. We secured the UN building until we were relieved, and they set up and put comms there. Now, Al-Zarqawi has since blown up the UN building. It doesn't exist anymore. So we're there for a period of time, and then LER comes back from the north, kind of with their tail between their legs. I mean, maybe not, but they're like, hey, we're heading to Decree, to Saddam's hometown, and we need trigger pullers. So that's the Task Force Tarawa, which is what we were attached to. And then we headed up through, headed north to Decree. Now, one thing was weird is like, they're, you know, they say that Fertile Crescent in Iraq is like the birth of civilization. I don't know if that's true, and I'm probably misstating, but there was a point where we felt like you're in Hawaii because there are palm trees, and it was just like this like microclimate that showed up out of nowhere, which was weird. Anyway, we get to the top, we get to Tikrit, and then there's this palace complex, which is like kind of like Las Vegas sort of situation, and it had been hit by, I don't know, be hit by missiles or whatnot. I'm not exactly sure, but so we get to the garage before the entrance, and I've got photos of this, and I've got Madskin over here. He's got a SMA on his shoulder, and he's like, I don't know, maybe 5 feet away, launches a SMA right through the front door of the palace. Boom. And then we funnel into the palace. It's the first toilet. I remember out there, I have a photo of the toilet. It was the first toilet we've seen in like forever. Anyway, we secured Saddam's palace, and we were there for a couple of weeks until the army relieved us. So we're still doing raids. We're still taking fire, the whole thing. And the place was just amazing. And there was an elevator in the center of the palace. We're like, let's just put a shape charge in the elevator. We'll go down because we know this thing is like man-made sort of canal. We know that there's stuff down there. We want to go check it out. We were never allowed to do it. Army comes in, relieves us. We find out later after we headed south. Army turns on the power. They take the elevator down. There's dinars, gold bullion, blocks of dollar bills. I mean, all the stuff. I mean, look, boot camp never ends on the grunts. It doesn't. So everything is regimented. I mean, there is no opportunity for not performing at your best.
Sure.
So none of that shit flies, and everybody knows about it, and it's not allowed. And so we did keep our honor clean 100%, but it still was kind of, we could have been a great photo op for all of us, but yeah, it was just, we were kind of like, we were on top of all of that, and we couldn't go down the elevator shaft. Anyway.
Yeah. I mean, I can only imagine the look on those guys' faces when they go down.
Oh my God.
Flip the lights on, and it's like the lights are shining off like the gold, and it's like, oh my God, I can't even see, it's so bright in here, you know. Like, I could only imagine like the reaction of all those guys. But
oh, I mean, the whole compound was just so amazing. And yeah, when we found out about it, we were pissed. We're like, what? But you know, so be it. I've got some great photos from the palace, and of course that was sort of like a we had all the 41s, which are all the artillery, and all of us. Once we secured it, the press showed up, and so I guess our unit was on the cover of the LA Times, and yeah, we got a lot of good press out of the deal. But one thing I want to say, which is really important here, and this is really important for everyone to know, in the very beginning, going from town to town, the locals were gracious. They were lovely. They were absolutely just really spectacular. They would show up. It was exciting for them because the Americans are here, and there were parades in a way. It was really nice. And I don't know if people know that that's what happened, because it was in every new village or town, we got the same response. And then, of course, you'd see in the back, you know, fancy watch, shiny shoe, Mad Dog, and you're like, oh, bath party, bath party, bath party, bath party. But, you know, like, they're the same everywhere. They just want to raise the family and have a business and be left alone. And that was definitely true for the Iraqis.
Yeah, that's what I've heard from a lot of people who've deployed, is that the locals in Iraq or Afghanistan, either place, and other, you know, places too, a lot of times the locals are super supportive, and they're glad that you're there, because there's a glimmer of hope for them that maybe things could get better for them. Maybe the Americans will come in and do something and make life a little bit better. You know, whether or not that came to fruition, you know, that's up to, for debate, I suppose. But, you know, but it at least, you know, gave them some hope, you know, for a period of time. And maybe for a period of time it was better, you know. And you know, I know Afghanistan kind of has slipped back to the way things used to be. But, you know, at least for, you know, 20 years or so, maybe there was a little bit of, you know, life that was better there. But, you know, I haven't been to Iraq, so I don't know, you know, specifically there, but I can only speak to, you know, my experiences. But so this deployment was obviously very kinetic, a lot of, you know, firefights, all those types of things happening, you know, seemingly on a daily basis. Eyes are being opened to a whole new way of life, basically, with the way things are going there. What was it like coming back home for you guys? What was it like for you? You know, was it readjustment getting back into, you know, the swing of things and the civilian side of things? Or, you know, how was it for you?
Yeah, I would do deployment over and over again rather than have to go through the readjustment. Hardest part of the entire deal. I mean, after Tikrit, we went down to Diwania where we were out. And we were under General Mattis. General Mattis was pretty much, ROE was whatever you want. I mean, that's not entirely correct, but not far from it.
Sure.
So we're in Diwania at an ammo depot, which was basically a Costco for IEDs. We didn't even realize at the time. Waiting to finally get orders to go back to Kuwait. But getting home, camp couch, all excited, looking forward to it, right? And then, of course, going through supplies just to wrap it up so you can finally go see your loved ones, like, forever.
Yeah.
But we're just thrilled. And then, of course, obviously, on the flight home, it's got to be the worst turbulence of any plane I've ever been on in my life. So you're like, great. And it's, we're going to go down with a plane. We survived the war, barely, and we're going to go down on a plane. Okay, great.
Right.
We finally get home. And yeah, there's a honeymoon period where you're like unfazed by anything and everything. Like, you are alive. You didn't think it was going to happen. There were lots of times you probably shouldn't be alive. Like, okay, we got our guys back. You're like, all right. So yeah, it was good. And then there's no sleeping with your wife or your girlfriend. Like, that isn't happening. Guys are sleeping on the floor. Guys aren't sleeping at all. And then we're like, well, let's get together. Cause this was that I was living in bed. I'd go back home to my roommate and it's like, I'm home then. So, you know, it's in Venice Beach. So I'm living in Venice. Everybody else is in West LA. We're like, let's get together. Let's go like hit the town, whatever. Like, we survived. We got a lot to celebrate. The moment, this is a weird phenomenon. This is a really weird phenomenon that I don't know if people talk about. Guys would show up at somebody's house. We all dressed up. We're like, we're going to go, you know. Everyone passes out. The weirdest thing. Because we can't sleep on our own with our loved ones or family or whatnot.
Yeah.
So the minute we got together, even just a few of us, we're about to go out. It's like 6:37, 8, whatever, about to go out. And everyone is just out cold. So we had this thing like, okay, guys, we can't sleep this time. We can't sleep. We got to like fight through. We got to sleep because we want to go out and have a good time. That was a weird phenomenon. But right around month 5 or 6 of being home is when it got really bad. Because what people don't tell you, and you find out, I'm just going to be honest. Like war is a drug. It's the greatest drug in my life. It was just, you know.
Yeah,
there is nothing like it.
Adrenaline is addicting. Yeah.
Oh, my God. And so you're looking for, you start to go through withdrawal, like chemical. I learned this at the VA and I was drawn out. You go through chemical withdrawals because the greatest pharmacy in the world is the one between your two ears. So I'm going through withdrawals and I'm like, I started drinking heavily and we're all doing dangerous stuff because you're looking for that fix that you don't have anymore. Sure. And that was an adjustment. I mean, the good news is nowadays, unlike Vietnam, all the guys you go as a group, you come back as a group. Before, you would be in the middle of a firefight, you get cold, and you'd be in a bar in New Jersey like 2 days later.
Right.
Like, that is horrific. I don't know if that's true. It's what I've been told. That's a horrific way to go and to readjust. So we readjust together, but we are all really like, we are all like a little off. I mean, I'm sitting in the dark Sherpa in my cave bar, and my mom's like, you got to go see somebody. I'm like, what are you talking about?
Yeah. Again, everybody's experience is going to be a little bit different. You know, some people handle things a little bit better than other people. And some people, like you were saying, they get addicted to that adrenaline, that rush of that whatever happens when you're getting shot at or getting blown up or whatever. There's something going on between your ears that is definitely producing some chemicals, and you kind of get addicted to it. And that's why a lot of times we start to see people, you know, come back home and they're engaged in a lot of risky activities, whether it's, you know, drugs or alcohol or you know, other risky things, you know, high adrenaline, you know, sports or things like that, you know, driving too fast or, you know, doing all these things that just kind of get the blood pumping, get that a little bit more adrenaline going. But it was interesting how you're saying how, you know, you guys really weren't, nobody was really sleeping that all that well, but once you guys are around each other, it's like you finally have that security blanket that you can, you know, wrap around you. If, you know,
it was weird.
My guys got my back. I know they got my back because we just came back from a terrible place and they had my back there. They'll have my back here too. So like, it actually makes sense. It sucks that that's the case, but it does make sense, right? What about getting back into work? I know you were in the reserves, so you kind of got back into work at some point, I'd imagine. What was that like, and how was it like getting back to working with civilians versus other military?
Yeah, so I went back to my computer job. You know, the Soldier Sailor Act, they have to keep it. Everyone was thrilled to see me, and, you know, they sent a care package, which is really sweet. You know, by the way, if you're going to sell extended care package, if you just send Sriracha, it's a win. Like, it's a win. It makes every MRE amazing, FYI. So I get back, and they throw a thing for me, which was really nice. And, yeah, it's funny because people are like, You're different. You come home different. You don't even know how you're what you perceive, you know. But
right,
I was, you know, like, you're never gonna be the same again. You're just not. So yeah, I came home and people were like, "Holy crap, who are you?"
And that's a tough thing to come back to, because as far as they're concerned, they're still the same people. Not really too much probably has changed for them. You know, they wake up and go to work every day like everybody else, just like it's any other day. You know, unless some real traumatic thing happened, you know, a loved one passed away or they got into a terrible accident or, you know, something like that. Not a ton's changing really in their life, probably in a lot of cases. But then you and, you know, other people who've been deployed go through a deployment, all the traumatic and, you know, stuff that goes along with a deployment. And yeah, of course you're going to be changed. Of course you're going to be different. Like, you had to be different, because think about that very first time when bullets were flying and you're like, wait, is this real? Is this, you know, is this actually happening? That was kind of like civilian version of you being put into that scenario. Then by the very last firefight that you were in, I'd imagine your reaction was a whole lot different than the very first time. So of course you changed, right?
Yeah, you're absolutely different. I mean, this is not politically correct, but I don't care. Our job is to hunt and kill human beings. That's it. Sure. That's the deal. That's the gig. That's what we do. That's what we're supposed to do. And we're fucking good at it. We just are. And it's also to do it honorably, and we have to do it so that we protect, you know, women and children, and we did a great job of that as well. Yeah. But yeah, you come. I mean, there are so many memories that are just not even suitable for podcasting. But you know, where you're having to, you know, it doesn't matter how old they are a potential threat, and you have to hold them at bay. And you're like, God, this is it. And at the time, you're not thinking in terms of politics. You're not thinking, you're thinking in terms of strategy and making sure the guy on the left and the right are taken care of. That is what your focus are, and making you eliminate the threat. But when you come home, like, all that stuff sort of bubbles up. And you're like, oh my God. At the time, you're like completely focused on mission. It's all mission priority, and that's it. And you're not emotionally involved in any of it. But yeah, when you come home, it all comes flooding back, and you're like, oh my God. And some of the stuff you just forget, because, you know, you're either moving too fast or you're like, yeah, I got, my brain does not have time to process shit like that. So.
Right. Yeah. And then at some point it does come back, you know, a lot of times where maybe you didn't process it at the time because I don't know, other stuff was happening and you just didn't have the time or the mental energy to be able to process it. And then, you know, 6 months after coming home, it's like, oh my God, I can't believe I remember this now. I did that thing. What do I do with this now? You know, how do I handle these memories and all that kind of stuff? So I would imagine, and your experience was probably, you know, similar to mine, you kind of just didn't feel like you fit in with the folks that you were working with anymore, right? I would imagine.
Well, so I had a computer job. So I'm a UX designer. I've been doing it since, I guess, the mid-90s now. But so I'm sitting down in web development. So sitting at my desk, I'm like, yeah, I can't sit still. And who the hell is behind me? And I'm just like, okay. All right. We're going to try that. You know, and it just, life is just never going to be the same again. I mean, eventually now it is, but. And so going to, let's go out to have pizza. Let's go to have pizza. That sounds like a great idea. No, it's not pizza anymore. It is, where's our entrances? Where is our exits? Who's the potential threat? It's looking for, scanning for, you know, the hypervigilance doesn't shut off like ever. It's just there constantly, like a VCR, the 12 that just keeps blinking nonstop. And so you're dealing with this all the time. And so eventually they let me go at my job, which was kind of a gift in a way, not for, you know, any reason that there was this downsizing. And then eventually I didn't have a place to stay. So I'm drinking and so I end up sleeping on the beach. So I'm a homeless guy on Venice Beach. Like, hey, I became the movie version of returning vet. And I got sober and a guy helped me and started living on his couch, and slowly but surely I started going to the VA. And Leslie Martin was the head of the West LA VA. She's since passed, but she was pretty amazing. And I just started sharing. And in those days, they weren't doing immersive therapy or cognitive behavioral therapy. They were doing group therapy, which I don't think was really helpful. So it was only later on, after the VA started to modify their PTSD treatment stuff, that it really started to help me quite a bit. But it was difficult. And I moved to Washington or Seattle to work at Microsoft, and, you know, got a new apartment, but it's a new area. I don't know the city well. And so I'm not going out at all. So if you're not careful, you become agoraphobic where you never leave the house.
Yeah.
So it was rough for a long, long, long time. And it got better. It did get better. But, you know, I had to talk about it. I don't want to talk about this shit. And, you know, meeting with other vets, things come up that you forget about. And so any organization there's an organization I think that's in Texas. I think they're San Antonio based. I'm not sure, but they get together and as they do humps all the time, like that thing, that if that was around when I got home, it would have been great.
Yeah. I mean, great. Yeah. And I think that's the reason why those organizations exist, is because, you know, obviously they didn't exist back then. And people found that type of camaraderie is helpful. And
oh my God,
getting folks together who have common backgrounds, common interests, common, you know, just military history, you know, it may not be I deployed at the same time as you in the same location or whatever, but, you know, even people who deployed to completely different areas at completely different times, I mean, we could probably find some common ground of stuff that, you know, we can still talk about, we can joke about, and sometimes that just makes it a little bit easier knowing that you're not the only one who has experienced this thing. And
oh, big time.
And it's just helpful to be around those people. And, you know, like you said, you know, doing some sort of physical activity as well, that helps as well. I mean, that gets the blood pumping, it gets things moving, and, you know, gets you out of the house, gets you off the couch, gets you moving. And it's just a win-win all around. It helps you mentally, helps you physically, and just kind of builds that camaraderie. It's not just helping that one person, it's helping that whole group of people by getting together like that, right?
It's true. And you can tell jokes without coming off as a monster, because I came home and they're like, tell me what it was like, you know. And the one question they all asked, did you kill anybody? And like, you never ever want to be it. You never want to ask, if a civilian listening to this, you never want to ask that. Like, that's not, you know.
Yeah,
you get that. You get that. And so you're like, well, I'm not, you know, you're like, okay, we're not talking about that. But then you're like, oh, yeah, there was this one guy, like, you know, so-and-so. And he was a Haji that was working on the base. And oh, what was he like? What was he? Oh, he got, who was he? You know, he was in Sturgeon. We had killed him. But anyway, and then you look back at their faces and they're white and their jaws on the ground and they're looking at you and what they heard.
Right.
Your lens is totally different from mine now.
Right.
I'm going to stop talking now.
Yeah, right. Before, you know, especially like in a work environment, like before HR gets called into the situation.
Oh,
right?
My God.
But that particular question, you know, did you kill anybody? You know, that civilians sometimes ask to folks who've been deployed. I look at that question as a type of question that no matter the answer that the veteran gives, the answer will change your opinion of that person.
Oh, my
and,
God.
And the reason why I say that is let's say someone asked you and you didn't kill anybody. No shots were fired. You didn't even have to clean your gun because it was, you know, spotless the whole time. You never had to shoot anybody, which, you know, that would be wonderful if you never had to do anything like that. But someone's going to look at you and be like, oh, well, you were probably just sitting on base all day and didn't really do anything. You didn't really do your job. You didn't do anything dangerous or tough or anything like that. So, well, that deployment doesn't really count is kind of the mindset that probably some people might have with that. Or you'll get the reaction that you were just describing, where you're describing, yeah, I did kill someone and this is what happened and blah, blah, blah. And then they're looking at you like, oh my God, this guy's a monster. You know, so regardless, one way or the other, the opinion is shifting. And that's like enough for me right there to just be like, look, either you like me or you don't like me as a person. I don't want to have to, you know, change your opinion, because either way, it's going to change it. And it may not be for the better. So, you know, I'm just not going to answer that question, you know?
You know, it's really, and I get it. Like, if you're an armchair sort of observer and you're watching it on TV and you see it and you're a big horror fan and you see it, you know, it's totally different from when you're on a battlefield and you're stepping over crispy critters, which are human beings that have basically burned alive.
Yeah.
And the smell of that, and then the fact that battlefields, because the thing they don't show in the movies is when people die, their bowels evacuate. They don't cover that on. So, you know, and how loud, it's so loud. And like, you can't tell people that stuff. You can't give them the details because, like, if they saw it in up front, they would go into a catatonic shock. Like,
yeah.
And it was kind of a wake-up call for me. I mean, obviously, this is a long time ago, but I was like, yeah, we're not talking about it. We're not going to say anything because anything we say, they're not going to have a point of reference to even comprehend it.
Right. And even from a, like, a movie perspective, like Saving Private Ryan or something like that, where, yes, you're seeing someone getting shot, you're seeing death, you're seeing these types of things, but it's still Hollywood. It's not
That's
real
right.
life. You know, that actor, as soon as that scene was over, he got up and he dusted himself off and he was fine. It's not like he actually had a bullet going through him. You know, it's totally different. So, you know, even if people think that they can relate to it through, oh yeah, well, it's kind of like what I saw in the movies. Well, not really, you know, it's different because there's no, I mean, the only senses that you're really experiencing during the movie is sight and sound, and you're not getting the smells or the taste of, you know,
the metal of the blood,
air, you know, whatever's in the air, and
yeah,
all that kind of stuff. It's like you're not getting the full experience through that, and be thankful that you're not, I suppose,
right.
is kind of the takeaway from that, right? Is you don't want to experience that kind of stuff. Thank God you don't have to. And, you know, thankfully people like you and other folks who've deployed went and did that stuff so that other people didn't have to, so that, you know, we didn't have more death and destruction on American streets, you know, in American cities, getting, you know, planes flown into buildings or, you know, bombs going off or any of those other things. You know, that's the way I look at it is, you know, we went over there, whether you're for the war or against the war, during that time period, we kept those people over there and not coming over here. We didn't have any more planes dropping out of the sky. So, you know, in that case, I look at it as, you know, mission accomplished. But, you know, thankfully, there were people who were able to do that so that other people didn't have to. and could live in blissful ignorance of everything that was taking place, right?
It's true. And even if you weren't a combatant over there, like just seeing the horrors of war up close, it's sure. a trick.
Yeah. 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 Because it's, I mean, it's not a, war is not a, on a traditional battlefield, like the way you might think of like the American Revolution or the Civil War or something like that, where it's just like a big open field with a bunch of soldiers who lined up and started shooting at each other. It's in cities where people live, civilians, women,
that's right.
children,
yeah. you
know, elderly people, like they're everything in between. And, you know, the enemy combatants that we had to face, they weren't wearing uniforms like, you know, other wars would have. So you didn't always know who the bad guy was. It could just be another guy walking around wearing the same clothes as anybody else. And then all of a sudden, oops, he has a bomb strapped to him. And, you know, it was just such a drastically different landscape than so many other wars that our country has fought that, you know, we had to adapt. And it was a rough, you know, thing to have to go through.
It was interesting because we were there for the invasion in the beginning, and you know, Saddam had his army, I think a million man army or something, maybe that's wrong. So of course, all the bunkers were loaded with uniforms.
Oh yeah,
just like changing out.
Yeah, yeah. Going through the experiences that you went through, you know, your time in the military, your deployment. And even, you know, before, you know, you were an adult, you had a, you know, adult job, you did, you know, all that stuff before the military. So you had that kind of adult perspective, adult civilian perspective. And then you join the military, then you get out and you're back into the civilian world. So you have a lot of that perspective that would probably be very helpful for folks who are coming out of the military, that transition period. If you could sit down with a young veteran who's transitioning out of the military, what do you think you would want them to understand about kind of that whole transition period? Plus, you know, what's next? What does that next career path look like for you?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So you're out, you've just gotten out. You got to give yourself a little grace because there is an adjustment period, whether you like it or not.
Yeah.
But you need to get busy too. If you stay at home and you just play Call of Duty and turn the, you know, close all the blinds, you're not going to make any growth. So you need to actively get off your ass, get into the gym, and find another veteran group and actively participate.
Sure.
Like that is the path forward. If you do not, and you start drinking and you start taking edibles or whatnot, you're sitting home and you're watching TV and you're watching war movies, and then crying or doing whatever else you're going to. Picking up a loaded 45 seems like a pretty good idea. And we do not want that. So you need to get active and be a participant in your life. And you say, well, why? Why do I have to do this? You have to do it for all the men and women who no longer have that option.
Yeah.
So you have to do it in honor of them.
That's true.
That's,
I mean,
that's why.
If you're struggling to find like that motivation, that is, I couldn't have said it better. I think that's the best motivation right there. I mean, I remember years ago, I was doing some like half marathons and like kind of like running and all that kind of stuff. And when I like the very first long run that I did after getting out of the military, and I kind of let myself get out of shape and everything. And so it took me some time to kind of work back up to, you know, where I was, but I remember the very first time I'm out there, I'm running and my legs are burning. My lungs feel like they're on fire. Like everything is just hurting and it's sucking. And I was like, I don't know if I can keep going. But then that thought that you just said is what kept me going and let me finish the route that I was running. It was that, hey, I get to do this. There's other people out there who cannot do this.
That's right.
You know, they didn't make it home. They're not lucky enough to be able to do this. They're not lucky enough to be able to suffer and suck the way I'm doing right now.
That's right.
You know, it's kind of, you know, a funny way to think of it, but it's true. You know, we have that ability. We have the, you know, the ability to wake up in the morning and make a decision to stay inside and play Call of Duty or not even get out of bed, maybe.
That's,
you
know, right.
You could make that decision, but what good is that? What good would that sacrifice from, you know, those folks who didn't make it back home, what good would that sacrifice have been for? You know, is that all for nothing? You're just kind of throwing it all away? Or can you get up and do something useful and meaningful and, you know, do something with whatever you have left of your life, you know, make the most of it. And trust me, I know it's hard to get yourself in that mindset. It's hard for me sometimes too. I struggle with that from, you know, time to time as well, but it's the thing that you kind of have to keep reminding yourself. And then, you know, eventually the more you do this type of stuff, the easier it gets. I'm not ever saying it's going to be easy and it's just going to be second nature 100% of the time, but it gets easier as you keep doing that. But if you, whatever it is that you do, if you just stay on the couch and you, or don't get out of bed, or, you know, don't go to work, or you don't do any of the things that you're supposed to do as a responsible adult, well, that's going to get easier. It's going to get easier to just stay inside and play Call of Duty.
That's right.
You know, but that's not going to really move the needle on your life, right? Like, looking back on your deathbed when you're, you know, 85, 90 years old or something like that, you're like, man, I'm really glad I got to play more Call of Duty, you know, when I was, you know, whatever age. Like, that's not what it's all about. And so, you know, kind of put things into perspective, I suppose, is the way to put it, right?
Live your best life in honor of those who no longer can. I mean, that is the quote. And it will require some serious self-discipline. You're going to have to dig deep, but you have to start being of service. You've got to start helping other people. When I'm being of service to somebody else, whether I'm helping them with the lawn, the yard, a resume, whatever it is, I'm out of me for a moment and I have some relief in that.
That's a good way to put it. Yeah. Because a lot of times, especially when you're, you know, just isolating yourself, you're in your own head. You got nobody else to, nobody else's head to get into, really. You're stuck in your own, and, you know, sometimes I don't want to be there. Like, I know what goes on inside of there. I don't want to be in there. So, if you could be helping somebody else and serving somebody else and helping them out in a way that helps you as well, and not in a selfish way, it's, you know, you both can benefit. It's not like, you know, you're only going to do something just because it's going to help you eventually. Like, yeah, you can help somebody else out and they can benefit too. So nothing wrong with any of that. So I think, you know, this is all really great advice. And I know, you know, your experiences are, I'm sure there's some folks out there listening right now. They're like, yep, I know exactly what he went through. I went through the same damn thing and it sucks. Some people might still be going through it because, you know, some people haven't figured it out yet and figured out how to, you know, make that transition and get out of their own way. But I think knowing that there are people out there who've lived that same experience, you know, like yourself and, you know, countless other people, they've lived that experience and have come out on the other side okay. You know, you're not 100% the same person that you were before. You never will be. And that's fine. Yeah. That's expected. I think with any experiences that any of us have ever in life, of course it's going to change us, you know, cool. You know, for the better or for the worse. I mean,
yeah,
things can happen and change us in all sorts of different ways. This is just one more of those changes. And, you know, again, it's not a good thing. It's not a bad thing. It's just a thing that happens. It's part of being human. We change, we adapt, and we overcome until we just give up and we stop doing it. And that's not a great way to be either. So
no, I agree.
So this has been a great conversation. I know we're getting kind of a little long on time here, but I do want to thank you for coming on the show, sharing your experiences, because
my pleasure. Yeah.
It's not the easiest thing to bring up some of those memories and start talking about some of those things. And so I really do appreciate you coming on and sharing and talking about those experiences, but more importantly, the advice that you gave, you know, talking about that young veteran just transitioning out of the military, you know, getting active, getting involved in community, doing something, not just sitting inside playing Call of Duty or, you know, whatever it is that they might be doing. I think that's really important. I think that's a message that a lot of people need to hear. And maybe they're not told that message often enough to really let that sink in. So I really hope that this message will sink in with some folks who might be listening to this episode. You know, even if we help one person, I think this conversation is definitely worth it. But I'm sure there's going to be a lot more people out there who hear this. And hopefully that's just that one more thing to help kick them in the pants and get them off the couch and
totally.
get them out there and live in life instead of just letting life pass them by. So, you know, thank you again, Ben, for taking the time to come on.
Hey, thanks for the opportunity. Absolutely. Sure.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, thanks again. And you know, for the listeners, you know, check out this episode, you know, and subscribe to the podcast, I should say, wherever you listen to podcasts, YouTube, all those things, we're all over the place. So check out that and definitely remember to subscribe. But Ben, thank you again.
Appreciate it. Thank you.